Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you see no reason to follow a belief or practice or a person like Jesus or God himself based upon blind faith. Well, either do I, my friend, either do I. I would consider that a waste of time, and that's why I do not follow God by blind faith. That's going to be the subject of our program today. I'm going to start with a comment from one of my listeners. This comes from Tim. If you've been following this show for any length of time, you're familiar with Tim. Nice guy, a skeptic who has written often and called the show often. He is responding to the Bob Siegel Show podcast, an episode from a couple of weeks ago. And so let me start from the onset with an obvious point, namely that to fully understand what we are talking about here, you should listen to that podcast. I don't mean you need to turn off the radio and go listen to it now, but listen to it when you get a chance. It was sent out on Good Friday and meant for both Good Friday and Easter. It was titled, Is the Resurrection of Christ Really a Fact of History? Its number is episode 164. If you subscribe to my podcast, you still have that episode. If you don't subscribe, subscription is free. Just go to cgmradio.com/Bob. That's cgmradio.com/Bob. Or you can just go to that page and listen to that particular episode without needing to subscribe to the entire series. Although why you wouldn't want to subscribe to the entire series, I'm sure I don't know. In this show, I talk about some historical facts associated with the death and burial of Jesus, including the fact that his body was guarded by Roman soldiers due to his claim that he would rise from the dead after dying. And of course, there was this concern that his disciples might steal the body to make it look perhaps like that resurrection had happened. And then I also talk about the widespread claim that this in fact did happen, that he did really rise from the dead. And then I go through various theories that attempt to account for his missing body through natural means. Did the Romans steal it? Well, the Romans had no such vested interest in Jewish religion and would be breaking their own laws at the risk of their own lives. Did his disciples steal it? They didn't have the courage to stick up for Jesus while he was alive. Why would they risk their necks for his dead body? And how would they have gotten by the Roman guards anyway? Did the Jewish authorities steal it? Well, if they had, they could have stopped Christianity dead in its tracks. The moment rumors of Jesus' resurrection began to spread, they could have produced the dead body. I went through all of that with much more detail, and again, the details are on that previous radio show, but I wanted to mention it here to offer at least enough summary so that you understand what we're talking about right now. With that in mind, here then is Tim's response, and he writes such a long letter that I'm going to break it up and I'm going to respond point by point at various intervals right after he makes them, but you will hear all of Tim's words. Tim says, I had a chance to listen to this podcast in its entirety. Let me first say that trying to pack in the range of arguments and issues you did in about 16 minutes is daunting. You could have dedicated 2 hours to any number of single points addressed and perhaps barely scratch the surface. That said, I would say I fundamentally disagree with the general premise of the attempt at using an historical approach. You essentially used the minimal facts technique made popular by Gary Habermas in relying on a number of basic, quote-unquote, historical facts that best point to resurrection. Suffering from the same constraints of brevity, I will still say that the foundational problem with this approach is that it makes the error of equating probability analysis of established natural events with that of supernatural events. In the context of historical analysis, nothing is an absolute fact in the way like a spherical earth or the boiling temperature of water is. History is based on degrees of probability. That JFK was assassinated has a high degree of probability. That Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in that assassination may have a lesser degree of probability, for example. Neither assertions are absolute facts. Okay, now let me respond, like I said, a point at a time. Now, that is true, Tim, and that is why I have often made a distinction on this radio show between proof and evidence. Obviously, history comes to us as evidence. Some evidence is better than others. On that, we agree. For proof, one must actually meet and experience God. And that is exactly what Christianity promises. That is something I have experienced, but we're not talking about that right now. We're in the category of evidence. Tim continues. In context of your podcast, the idea that Jesus was an itinerant preacher with followers preaching something, an end of the Roman occupation via end of the world and general resurrection gospel, has a reasonably high degree of probability, as that was not unusual in that time or region. The same with crucifixions generally, and that Jesus may have been crucified for heresy. Nothing about these assertions are unusual or runs counter to everything else we currently know about that time and place. That Jesus would have been buried in a tomb rather than a common grave does run counter to what was overwhelmingly the normal practice and therefore has a lesser degree of probability. I would challenge that, Tim. I would challenge that, yes, lesser degree of probability in general, but not lesser degree of probability when someone has the fame of Jesus. We are told that a rich man purchased his body and buried it in a tomb so as to better honor him. There is no compelling reason to dismiss that or even to say that it was improbable given the gigantic movement Jesus started. Tim continues, reciting Roman practice of punishing grave robbing or breaking seals does not elevate the probability of the claim of being buried in a tomb after crucifixion. Well, I never said it did, Tim. I never said it did. I said it elevates the improbability that the Romans would have robbed the grave and broken the seal at threat of their own lives, regardless of what kind of grave it was. Tim continues, more importantly, that the authors of the Gospels may have accurately recited various aspects of life at the time does not necessarily mean that everything they recite is accurate. Well, yeah, Tim, but we can say that about anything. If that's our problem, we've just thrown out all ancient history. But if these were the people who followed Jesus around for several years, then just who would have been more accurate back then? Who would have been more reliable? Tim continues. But even if we could reasonably say all of the presented quote-unquote facts have a high degree of probability, including an empty tomb, there remains no way of establishing the historical probability of the empty tomb being attributable to a dead body coming back to life after 2 days. The recitation of the 500 is based on one statement by Paul, who is reciting what is believed to be an older creed. Okay, back up, Tim. First of all, I went through one at a time the natural explanations of what happened to the body. And since they did not hold up, we need to be open to the possibility of a miracle here. But I want to also talk about this point you're making with Paul and the talk about the 500. I did make the point in that broadcast that we have evidence for the miracles and resurrection of Christ from historical documents outside of the New Testament as well. I promised I would go through that evidence in part 2 of the program, which was a separate podcast. It was broadcast the next day. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the second podcast. Either way, while I did share evidence for the historical trustworthiness of our collection of 27 ancient New Testament documents, I also showed respect for those who would want to see something outside of the New Testament. We have the writings and reports of Josephus, Tacitus, rabbis in the Jewish Talmud. All of these I went through. Obviously, we can't go back through time and interview every one of the alleged 500 witnesses, but Paul himself is referring to this as common knowledge. That doesn't make it automatically true, but it does make it very significant. Just because you call it a creed, that doesn't isolate his statement from the historical context. And Paul himself goes on to say that Christ also personally appeared to him. He counts himself beyond the 500 witnesses. Something happened back then, Tim. This movement got so big it hit the shores of Rome and caught the attention of Roman historians such as Tacitus. And Tacitus was not a Christian. But again, that category is evidence. Tim continues. Unlike the other minimal facts, there is no historical or common reference point for establishing probabilities for such events. The only reason we can establish probabilities of the other contentions is based on how we understand things to have worked in the past and how things normally work in our world generally. There is no equivalent for the resurrection itself or any supernatural claim for that matter. I am not saying arguments cannot be made. What I am saying is that when historical means of establishing probabilities of claims events are not available, as is the case with supernatural claims, we really aren't engaging in historical analysis. Sure we are, Tim. Sure we are. And I do believe that this is the crux of the problem. Tim, while acknowledging historical probabilities with natural events, is saying we need to have a different criteria for supernatural events. I have heard this argument before. I have heard it often. The way it's usually phrased is extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. And I completely reject this viewpoint. Either we have evidence or we don't. It's either good evidence or it isn't. Our process for examining historical evidence must be objective. If we are going to begin with the bias that miracles are impossible, or even the bias that miracles are unlikely, then no amount of historical evidence will ever be enough. And I have heard skeptics admit that no evidence will ever be enough. Tim continues, if this weren't the case, then the historical claims of many religions and other traditions would also have to be accepted as true. No, Tim, they wouldn't have to be accepted as true. They would have to be examined. I have no problem examining the claims of other religions. Usually they do not make them and instead talk only about faith. But some do make them, and sure, when they are made, they should be examined. When I do examine them, I do not see the overwhelming case in these religions that can be made with the resurrection and Christianity. But face it, here's what we're dancing around. Will historical reporting of miracles be accepted just as we would accept any other historical reports? If the same number of eyewitnesses and historians who recorded the resurrection merely reported that a man named Jesus had started a revolution in 33 AD, no one would doubt it. The incredible miracles associated with the resurrection and life of Christ understandably create tougher standards and greater skepticism, but are such special criteria fair? They may be understandable. Are they fair? Or do they instead close our minds to the witness of history? Think about it once again. If you're going to start by assuming that miracles are impossible or assuming that miracles are unlikely, it will never matter to you how much evidence is brought forth, because all data will be immediately dismissed. An open mind ought not to assume that miracles are impossible. After all, when the Bible talks of miracles, it's not assuming that God waved his hands like a magician and threw natural law out the window. God, as the author of life, is also the author of all scientific law. If science has taught us one lesson over the ages, it's that humankind frequently learns to do things previous generations would have thought impossible. Imagine somebody in 70 AD looking at a television set, or a telephone, or a computer. Imagine their expressions if they could watch a rocket blast off and land on the moon, or if they could see a jet touch down on a runway. To them, such technology would appear very miraculous indeed. Obviously, to us, these are not miracles, but rather a harnessing of scientific knowledge previous generations had not yet discovered. Likewise, it is easy to assume that human beings 1,000 years in the future, or even 100 years in the future, when we see how fast recent technology has developed, will be able to do things which would absolutely baffle our minds. If it is so easy to believe that people will be able to do that someday, why is it so hard to imagine that God can do these things right now? A true open mind will not assume that miracles are impossible, because the testimony of science is actually provided evidence to the contrary. Miracle is just a descriptive word for something science currently cannot explain. And I realize, Tim, you're not going so far as to say they're impossible. I realize that. My point, the resurrection or any other event in the Bible should be examined with the same test we would use for any other historical event. Tim continues, the reality is, virtually all believers throughout the history of Christianity have accepted the Easter story not based on arguments of historical reliability, as you seem to acknowledge in your podcast, but on faith and conviction. Well, that's true, Tim, and that's a sad truth. It's a sad truth that I actually begin my book with, my book on apologetics, because the New Testament writers did not define faith the way people define faith today. They talked about the resurrection as an historical fact. They talked about a relationship with God as something real and genuine that goes through our senses. Faith had to do with trusting God to work in your life. It wasn't this blind assertion of his existence or of the resurrection. They talked factually about those things. And as a Christian, I'm not afraid to criticize erroneous practices in the church. I do it all the time. I think it's important important for us to be self-reflective that Christians have not been well-educated in the field of apologetics. It's very tragic. It does not, however, take away from the apologetic historical arguments which can be made. Tim continues, I'm not arguing against any of that here and have no interest in doing so. In fact, I recognize the power and beauty of the story itself. Well, I appreciate that, Tim, but for me, it's not a story. No matter how beautiful a story may or may not be, if it isn't actually true, then it is a waste of time to commit one's life to it. I don't mind reading a novel or watching a movie, but I'm not committing my life to those. If I were not absolutely 100% certain that Jesus is God incarnate based upon a genuine, real relationship that I have with him, well, then I can think of about 100 things I'd rather be doing with my time. Tim continues, my comments are on the intellectual exercise, not personal faith. If you are inclined to address this on one of your shows or podcasts, I would be very interested in defending my position there, as I would agree social media is not the best forum for such a discussion. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I did tell Tim that I was responding to his comments on today's show. He was invited to call in, and he expressed interest in doing so. He may still do so, but either way, Tim, it's always good to hear from you. God bless you. And I don't say that based on faith. I say that based on knowledge of a real God who I know wants to bless you. Oh, one more thing, Tim. I did want to respond to this as well. When you say that historical means of establishing probabilities of claimed events are not available, as is the case with supernatural claims, there have been many supernatural claims throughout history and even in our own day, our own time. I was a contributing writer for a book written by Jim Garlow called Miracles Are For Real. So we do have a basis of comparison. Anyway, just wanted to add that. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious, obvious. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church.
Skyline Church.
I was reading a lengthy email and lengthy reply from me to Tim Campen, and he did call in as he was invited to. Tim and I don't agree on much, but I always enjoy talking to him, and he is always welcome on this program. Tim, welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I'll let you, go ahead and respond to my response.
Well, before I get into maybe the point by point that you did in response, and I do appreciate how you did that. I thought it was helpful doing it point by point the manner that you did. I would like to just get to the point about probability analysis. And again, you mentioned that there seems to be good evidence that miracles have happened, and therefore we do have a sense of establishing some sense of probability analysis. But what I haven't heard from you, and what I've never heard from any apologist, frankly, is how you apply that probability analysis. You do a really good job of probability analysis in saying, here's all the reasons why these natural explanations for the empty tomb are improbable. And you put it out there really well, and you give all very good coherent arguments for why they're not probable, using all natural understood facts. Right? I use facts in the sense of what we believe to be true about the time and place. But when it comes to the supernatural side, the probability analysis completely changes. The criteria completely changes. So perhaps you can explain to me how you can say the probability that you know, let me just give you a story about how possibly the tomb could have been empty. Okay, suppose early Saturday morning, 2 a.m, supposing Jesus, the body of Jesus was in the tomb, and suppose there was a Roman guard posted around there somewhere. 2 a.m, you have a couple followers of Jesus. These are not people that are documented, people remember, but they were fairly devout at the time. Say they're young, 15 years old. Their brains have not developed risk-taking measures yet, as we know scientifically and through insurance premiums. So their brains have not developed risk-taking measures and how to avoid risk-taking. They go, they roll the stone aside, which obviously wasn't a big deal to roll the stone aside because we know women were going to come on the third day to anoint the body, and women were going to do it. So we know that's not a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Let me just stop you there. For the women to have gone and anointed the body, the Roman soldiers would have had to help them roll the stone away. They would have still had to get permission.
You don't know that.
We do know that because it was being guarded by Roman soldiers. You don't just walk past the Roman army and do whatever you're going to do, especially if you're in a conquered territory like Judea was. Sorry, Tim, I can't buy that. I was interested up to then, but I'm not with you on that one.
Most of the time, tombs were not guarded. This was a special occasion.
Of course.
Right?
Well, exactly. It was a special occasion. Okay. And because it was a special occasion, part of that special occasion was they were not going to get into that tomb without getting permission and help from the Roman guards. And the Roman guards were not going to do that because they would have to break a Roman seal and defy the order of the governor.
And you also agree that it was overwhelmingly the job of women to anoint the body in the tomb, in 18 tombs at the time.
I don't think it was restricted to women, but yes, women were generally in the habit of going and anointing bodies. It was kind of a patriarchal culture, yes.
So the idea that the Roman guard was there to help them is not why the Roman guard was there. And the expectation that the Roman guard would help them has nothing to do with why the women would go. And otherwise, if there was no guard there, they would be able to go and get into the tomb.
Tim, whatever expectation they had, whatever they thought they were maybe going to do, they were not going to get into that tomb without the permission of the Roman guards. Now, we don't have these women here to interview, and neither one of us is a mind reader, but they were not going to get past those Roman guards.
I agree. But we can agree also that if a Roman guard could help them roll the stone, then a couple of 15-year-olds probably could have done it.
Yeah, and if he was dumb enough to put his own life on the line for just a dead body of a Jewish person that his land had conquered. I mean, anything is possible, Tim. I'm going to go back to your word of probabilities. You're now switching from what's probable to what's possible. Does this sound probable to you, this scenario?
No. What do we know about human behavior and 15-year-old boys? What do we know? We know they do stupid, stupid, life-risking things for things that are much, much, much less important than someone believing it's their Messiah.
Okay, then why didn't they do those stupid life-risking things and stick up for Jesus while he was alive? His disciples fled. John at least hung around the cross.
I don't want to get stuck to an aside on that, but that's probably, I think that if all the miracles that are attributed to Jesus had happened during his lifetime, they would have, because there were lots of resurrections that happened before Jesus' resurrection, you'll recall from the Gospels. And there were witnesses to these things, and their followers were witnesses to all these resurrections. So the idea that, seriously, that they probably would have if all those miracles happened.
Human behavior can be very cowardly, and the Bible is full of examples of God doing all kinds of wondrous miracles, and none of them were greater than the stuff that went on at the time of Moses, and yet look how many people deserted Moses and said, I want to go back to Egypt. So since you're talking about human behavior, let's really talk about it. Yeah, I agree with you. Human behavior can be very irrational, and a lot of times, as it relates to God, even though God has proven himself many times in people's lives, they still go out and do dumb things. God has proven himself to me a million times over since I became a Christian at 19 years of age. There are still times I let God down. I will freely confess that. So if we're going to talk about human behavior, that's not that big of a hop, leap, and a jump that people, despite seeing, yeah, they saw him do miracles, but then he got arrested, and that kind of freaked them out. The Jewish expectation of Messiah was somebody who was going to go into Jerusalem as a warrior, as a king. They got very confused when Jesus allowed himself to be arrested. They might have thought, gee, maybe somehow God's not behind him anymore. Something. Okay, he did miracles, but something's up. The big problem, and it goes partly to the explanation, a huge part of the explanation, is that they were very confused that Jesus had been arrested and that he allowed himself to be arrested more specifically.
Okay, so getting back to my scenario.
Okay, sure.
You have some 15-year-olds, and if you want to see how dumb 15-year-olds can be, watch YouTube. You could watch it for days and see things they do. Look at the Tide.
They weren't quite as dumb in those days because you were considered an adult at a much earlier age, and they had a different kind of education. But I will go halves with you. I would say that a 15-year-old in those days may at least have been partially as dumb as a 15-year-old today.
Well, the thing, that's why I referenced it, I realized that there are some cultural differences with that. That time. But the fact remains that biologically, the brain is poorly developed for recognizing risk up until around 25 years old. And so that's just a biological fact. So suppose just for a moment, you have a couple 15-year-olds who were devout followers, and they thought it was, they didn't like what was happening, and they decide they're going to take it on themselves. The Roman guard dozes off. They wait for him to doze off. They get in there. They get the body.
Okay, you realize that Roman guards, when they guarded things, guarded on shifts, and some were asleep and some were awake. So there's always somebody awake.
Fall asleep on the job. We know people fall asleep on the job, right? We know that.
Not when they're in shifts. And we also know that it was against the law, and a Roman could be executed for falling asleep on the job. So again, Tim, is anything is possible? I want to bring you back again to your probabilities. How probable is this scenario you're throwing out?
Okay, so it's as probable as our experience of people on, you know what, you know how often people who are on guard in military installations in hot zones, they fall asleep too. It happens all the time. They get court-martialed. And that's life or death kind of situations. So it does happen. And to think that somehow that the Romans were impervious to something we know happens.
Tim, if it was one Roman guard by himself falling asleep, maybe. They were in shifts. Some were asleep, some were awake, and more than one would have been awake guarding it at the time. So you're suggesting that several of them just all fell asleep at the same time? These are the Romans. They had conquered the whole Western world, practically. They had enough on the ball to guard one dead man's body.
So what you're saying is that there's no way that the Romans would have accepted silver to say that they fell asleep or anything like that? That something just happened to the body?
You could occasionally have somebody take a bribe, but this is not very likely. And there were several of them. If one of them wanted to take the bribe, there are going to be others there that say, hey, I'm not going to be a part of this. They're risking their lives. Again, we can always throw out
a
scenario.
Doesn't the Gospels talk about a bribe?
What's that?
Doesn't the Gospels talk about the Gospels talk about the Roman soldier was given silver?
There were Romans that were given bribes over other things. They're not going to put their lives at risk for a bribe. Again,
not to say anything. They're given silver.
After the resurrection. Yes, and those people that told them to go and float that story promised that they would go to Pilate and cover for them too. So the Romans still had that fear.
Right. So I mean, the whole silver story is improbable, right?
Again, anything is possible. It is improbable.
Right. And so we know that improbable things happened with the Romans according to the Gospels themselves. If they're willing to accept silver
if you're going to go through that, okay, but you've got to go through that story and get it right. That was not a story about the Romans being bribed to turn the other way while people stole a body. They came and gave a report to the chief police that something supernatural had happened, that they had seen an angel, or they probably didn't call it an angel. They saw a supernatural being, that it was supernaturally rolled away. They didn't know what was going on, and they were not in the best state of mind. And they said, well, go ahead and spread this story. They probably thought at this point there's nothing to lose. This story is probably better than, you know, if we were to try to present this fantastic story to Pilate, we're really going to be in trouble. And these guys are saying, well, if you'll change your story, we'll protect you from Pilate. So there were a lot of extenuating circumstances in what actually happened with the bribe that they took. That was a whole different kind of bribe for a whole different kind of reason.
Right, but they took bribes. So we know that.
I didn't say that they never took bribes. I talked about the improbability that they are going to take a bribe for turning the other way and letting somebody steal the body of Jesus. So let's put right, our remarks so in the context with which they were said.
Let's assume it's improbable, okay? It's improbable that they would have... That
yes.
Let's say two Roman soldiers, they took shifts, and it's improbable that while one was asleep, that the other would have fallen asleep. Say, that's improbable.
That is not probably only improbable, but legally just not the way Romans guarded tombs. Yes.
Okay, so it's improbable that would have happened. And we have a basis for that based on history and based on multiple sources of how Romans behaved and what the consequences were for not doing your job. Right?
Correct. We actually have Roman historians that tell us these things about the Romans.
Right. But suppose they grabbed the body and they were caught, they would have been, I think you would agree, executed on the spot.
Yes, they would have been, or at least turned over for execution.
Okay, but they very well could have been executed on the spot for doing that.
Roman law. There would have been a procedure to take them to Pilate, but there were, again, cases where the Romans would look the other way and things would get out of control. So that, again, would fall under the category of anything's possible but not probable. You're building a big case based on...
Execution, killing someone while they're trying to steal the body is something that's...
We killed her because she was still in the process of resisting us, resisting arrest. Sure, that's different. I thought you were talking about she tried to do it. She got caught. She's in chains, but we're going to execute her on the spot. At that point, the procedure would have been to take her to Pilate and have him order the execution.
Yeah, this would have been in the heat of stealing the body and not complying. Roman soldiers. Very well, very likely even, would have killed him on the spot. Now you've got three bodies there. What are you going to do with them? You're not going to put the two boys in the tomb. You just grab all three, you throw them in a common grave. They would have been unrecognizable, and no one told anyone. The boys didn't tell anyone. No one told anyone this was going to happen. The women show up on Sunday. The tomb is rolled aside. It's empty, and now you have an empty tomb. Okay, so that's an empty tomb.
Wait a minute. How did Jesus' tomb get empty just because these women were arrested trying to open the tomb?
No, I'm going back to the 15-year-old boys who stole the body. In the process of stealing the body, they were killed by the Roman guards. And the two boys...
You're bringing them to the point where they've already rolled the boulder aside and started stealing the body before they were stopped. Talk about improbabilities, Tim.
Okay,
Tim, I'll throw you a bone. Anything's possible, even this cockamamie theory you're putting out. But you're the one who's talking about probabilities. You're the one who started out using the word probabilities. But now you're switching gears and you're trying to make a case for what could be remotely possible. Anything's remotely possible, or practically anything's remotely possible. But I agree with you that we should actually stick to the probabilities. What you're saying is just not probable, given the way Romans guarded bodies. It's just not.
It isn't probable, but everything I've said is based on things we know well about humans, human behavior under comparable circumstances, and we can say we know these things do happen, period. The penalty for grave robbing was death.
The penalty for grave robbing was death. Pilate would have enacted that, but if they were in the process of being arrested and resisting arrest, now we're imagining some Jewish 15-year-olds resisting the Romans. Again, if you want to say that that's possible, fine, but I know you had a lot of other points. If you want to stay on this point, we will. I'll keep telling you that anything's possible, and I'll keep telling you that this is not probable at all.
So what is the probability? You made lots of good rational reasons why that has a low probability of happening, right? You gave lots of reasons, and
low
all
probability
based on what we know about history.
Yes, a low probability of the Romans stealing the body, or the Jewish authority stealing the body, or the disciples stealing the body. A low probability. Yes.
Low probability. And that would include the example I gave also has a low probability.
Yes. So now you're okay. going to say, well, then therefore the resurrection's a real low probability because we never witnessed that. Is that where you're going with this?
No, I'm saying show me the same probability analysis because we have so much understanding about how things would have worked under the circumstances, as I think your argument is where is the equivalent for bodies coming back to life after being dead for 2 days?
Well, if we're talking about a probability of miracles, I would go back to a point that I made, and it all goes back to how we are defining miracle, that the Bible is not defining miracle as God waving a magic wand, but merely knowing some things about scientific law that we don't yet know as the establisher of scientific law. And we see in the change of technology and the many things we do today that would have looked miraculous to people back then, I think the progression in science shows a lot of probability that what human beings think is impossible is not impossible. If you're asking me whether bodies pop out of the grave every day, no. But miracles do go on, those that are called miracles. And in science, we see things that would have once been called a miracle and now aren't. So I think there's a lot of probability we can look at there.
You did a point-by-point probability analysis for every point I make. And all I did was do the exact same thing with a body coming back to life after 2 days, not general miracles. And I didn't say the word miracle. All I said was the probability of a body coming back to life after being dead for 2 days. That's it. It was a very discrete point, not general, very discrete, the way you did it with my examples. So I'm using the exact same technique that you used.
Okay, the probability of a body coming back to life is that Jesus predicted he would come back to life. The probability is that Jesus predicted that in the context of the God of Israel. The probability is that he predicted that in the context of Israel's rich history, which had all kinds of miracles. And you yourself said there had been other reports of resurrections, and you were right about that. That's where the probabilities are.
I'm talking about probabilities that we know beyond the Bible, because when you addressed everything that I brought up, you didn't use any biblical sources for that.
Well, right? I think maybe you caught the part where I mentioned I did do a podcast the next day that you were responding to part
and
one
I read
of a two
it,
part.
And I listened to it.
Okay, so I did go.
I know all about it.
All right, so I did go and I looked at sources outside of the Bible, including Josephus, the Talmud, where even the enemies of Jesus who hated Jesus were admitting that he did live, that he was executed, that he did do miracles. They tried to attribute them to Satan, because they didn't like him, but they did admit that he did miracles. And so,
you're talking about the Talmud?
I am talking about the Talmud, right, in that particular instance.
Well, that'll be a point for a different show, because I disagree with you on that one. But
you disagree with me, Tim? I'm so shocked I'm ready to fall out of my chair. Well, of course you disagree with me. But I did make the point. We do. You made the point a moment ago that in that particular show, I was all in the Bible, and then I made the point that there was a subsequent show where I looked at things outside of the Bible. You said you've since listened to that. So, okay. So I have made points outside of the Bible, the miracles of Jesus, testimony of the resurrection of Jesus. Even a report from Pontius Pilate himself about a lot of the things we read in the Gospels. And I understand that people dispute those things. They dispute them all the time, but I have answered those disputes, and I don't think they hold up.
And you're the only apologist I've probably ever heard that put that much credence into the Acts of Pilate, not the 4th century, but what is believed to be the source referenced
well,
by other...
Well, you've probably discovered by now that I don't reach my conclusions based on taking a poll of what the other apologists say. I'm very aware that a lot of apologists will dismiss that. I think part of the problem... Well, there's two problems, and I acknowledge them both. The Acts of Pilate is referred to by ancient documents that we do have that document itself is missing. So people are uncomfortable with that. I understand that. And there is a false apocryphal document called the Acts of Pilate, too. So a lot of times, the minute people hear the Acts of Pilate, it becomes guilt by association. But since you listened to that other broadcast, you're familiar with the defense I made. But it is not an argument for me to say, well, so many apologists say this, so I need to throw my camp with them. I don't go with majority opinion. I go by what I'm studying and the conclusions I'm reaching.
Getting back to probabilities.
Okay.
When I was addressing, you know, the idea that you said it's improbable that they would have fallen asleep on the job, but we know people fall asleep on really important jobs all the time. So we have a context of what I'm talking about. We also know that 15-year-olds do death-defying, stupid, stupid things.
Okay, so since you want to stay here, Tim, then I'm going to ask you, you want to stay here? I'll stay here all day. Once again, why didn't they do these stupid, death-defying things while Jesus was still alive, where it could have really done some good? Where are they summoning the stupidity and or courage to risk their necks for a dead body when they fled and hid after he was arrested? Everybody knew where Jesus was. He was at Pilate's Praetorium. Everybody, there was a whole crowd watching him be crucified. Why didn't these death-defying people run in? I even saw that one of the movies called The Robe, and of course it was a fictitious movie, where Victor Mature ran and tried to stop a Roman from whipping Jesus. Okay, that was fiction. That was a movie, a good movie, but just a movie. So why didn't they do it then? Why didn't they do those death-defying stunts then?
How do you know they didn't?
Well, there's no record that they didn't. Once again,
there's no record of most of Jesus' life. You don't know anything about
most of his life. Well, but we know a lot about the last 3 years of his life and his ministry because it was recorded by several eyewitnesses and a historian named Luke who interviewed many eyewitnesses. So, yeah, we don't know his whole life, but we know a lot about his life.
And we also know that the Gospels and Acts, for example, they don't record everything that happened.
Of course they don't.
There's lots of things that happened.
Of course they don't, but that doesn't mean that what they're recording isn't true and isn't valid.
Right, but the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
That is correct, but again, you're getting back to probabilities. What they do record is that this crowd turned against Jesus. The same crowd that was shouting Hosanna on the day he rode into Jerusalem a week later is yelling crucify him. And that we have seen often, crowd control, crowds being easily turned, and we're told why that happened. The leaders of the Sanhedrin went in and worked the crowd. And so they do record that
happened. That's human behavior. Yeah, we know that's human behavior.
Exactly. So, yes, so we were looking at different aspects of human behavior. The difference is the human behavior that I just talked about is recorded in the Gospels. Could there have been somebody that tried to do something stupid and rescue Jesus? Again, it's possible, but what we're seeing is that the high majority of his followers turned against him, including his own disciples who followed him around for years. And he had more than just 12. He had over 100 disciples following him around.
And so getting back to the probability of a body, of just generally speaking, not getting to God or miracles or anything like that, because the whole point, I think the point, correct me if I'm wrong, is the point of your talking about the resurrection as being something of evidence of God?
Well, there's a lot of evidence, but that is one of them. I'm talking about the historical evidence of people who claim they were eyewitnesses to the resurrection, and then the historical evidence of looking at the other possibilities of what happened to the body. It's a united whole. We've got to look at several things.
No, but it's among the arguments used to establish that God is real, correct?
It is one of them. It is certainly not the only one. I use many of them.
Right. And so in order to have the idea of miracles, you have to presuppose God.
Well, no, well, you're saying we have to presuppose God. What was going on in biblical days is that people were actually in a relationship with God. I'll go back to something I said earlier when I was defining the difference between evidence and proof. We can look at historical evidence. It could be good evidence. It could be not so good evidence. But evidence only takes us so far. When we talk about proof, if one wants proof that God actually exists, they need to meet and encounter God. And this is exactly what the Bible promises. When I talk about evidence, I'm talking about a trail of breadcrumbs God has left. When I'm talking about proof, I'll just speak for myself. I have a personal relationship with God. There may be others who presuppose God. You are talking to somebody right now who does not presuppose God. The first years of my life, all the way up till through high school, through a senior high school, I was an atheist. For several years after that, an agnostic. Did not become a Christian until I turned 19 years of age, and that was because of a personal encounter with God.
So I'm not talking about presuppositionist or anything like that. What I'm talking about is, for your logical argument, you're presupposing God to say, my argument for God, one of my arguments in support of the existence of my God is the historical reliability of the Gospels and these miracles that happen. And for these miracles to happen, you need the God to exist. There's something of a begging the question that's necessarily happening, which is why I'm asking, how do you rely on God?
Yeah, obviously, for a miracle such as death coming back to life, you would have to assume that it is God doing it. What I'm saying is, I'm not just assuming God. I know for a fact that God exists. But if I'm talking to somebody who does not know that, I'm saying, yes, you could look at this world and say, if God doesn't exist, this miracle seems impossible. On the other hand, if God does exist, if God is our creator, then how hard would it be for him to create somebody and recreate life? So absolutely. Where a person stands with God is going to make a big difference. And we're down to our last minute, so we'll have to make this quick.
Well, if you presuppose, any religion can presuppose their God to make their claims make sense. And so what I was looking at, the probability is, what is general, I think we'll both agree, the probability of someone, of a body coming back to life after being dead for a good 48 hours at least, is very, very low. And that we really have no real experience, no verified experience of that type of thing happening.
Except that it's possible and very probable if there is a God, and there's all kinds of evidence that there is some kind of God, all kinds of evidence for the Bible, and there is also the proof that people can meet and encounter God. Well, Tim, we're going to have to leave it right there, but hey, buddy, it's always great talking to you. It's always fun, and you're always welcome on this program.
Thank you for the lively discussion.
All right, I enjoyed it very much. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.